Welcome to New World Notes. This is Kenneth Doust. In studying 17th century England, historian Joyce Malcolm focused on conflicts of the individual versus the state. In time, she began to study one particular arena of this conflict, the right of self-defense in history and law. On October 7, she spoke at the University of Hartford on American gun control, the landmark Heller Supreme Court decision, the right of self-defense, and the meaning of the Second Amendment. In a recent episode, we heard this last part on the Second Amendment. In case you missed it, the Supreme Court and Malcolm agree that the right to keep and bear arms is a right of the individual citizen. Gun control laws can still be enacted, but not as extreme as the one Washington, D.C. enacted in 1976, which effectively banned the possession and use of guns even for self-defense in the home. Today we'll hear Malcolm speak first on the facts of the D.C. gun ban. This was the law that the court recently found unconstitutional in the Heller case. Then she will discuss the evolving, or rather devolving, right of self-defense in England. Here's Joyce Malcolm.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank the Civil Liberties Committee, too, for inviting me and everyone for turning out on a blustery fall evening in Connecticut. I'd like to just start by giving you a description of the day on which the Heller case was heard, and then I will go into a bit about the background of it and some of the other things I'll explain in a minute. A year ago, March of 2008, was the date on which the oral argument before the Supreme Court of the United States was heard on this case involving the gun ban law that Washington, D.C. had imposed in 1976. The Supreme Court gets something like 4,000 petitions every year to hear cases. So they're getting about 150 a week. And very few, as you can imagine, ever get heard by the court. On this morning, people have been standing all night for places to be in the public gallery. The lawyer's line for this case started at 6 in the morning. Huge crowd waiting to hear the judges and to hear the attorneys argue this case. The reason that it was so important was that it was the first time that the Supreme Court had ever really decided on the core meaning of the Second Amendment. I've got the text of it because I'm sure that not all of you know the full text of the Second Amendment, although it's emblazoned on my mind from years and years. It's a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. For years, there had been no real debate about what that meant. Most Americans thought that it meant that they had an individual right to be armed. And only in the 20th century, early in the century, there were some restrictions made because there were worries in the North about a lot of immigrants coming in and people worrying about their having guns. So New York passed the Sullivan Act, and in the South, worries about blacks being armed, people wanting to restrict what other people could do. It wasn't really debated that much until the Kennedy assassination. And from the 1960s on, there were a whole lot of theories about why it did not mean that there was an individual right. The court's question, and they really can kind of choose what they want to look at, their question that they took up was whether the District of Columbia prohibition on the possession of usable handguns in the home violates the Second Amendment to the Constitution. And so what I'd like to do is to talk about that statute, the people involved in the arguments, and then give you some background on the whole concept of, that's, I believe, at the core of it, of self-defense, and how America and Britain, who bequeathed us this concept, have sort of diverged and gone in different directions and what that means to everyone. I should say that it was with great foresight that the committee invited me today, because on the 30th of September, the court has agreed to hear another case involving the Second Amendment, this time to decide whether the Heller decision, which said that there was an individual right, applies to the states. It has to be incorporated so that it isn't just the federal government that's involved. But first, let me tell you a little bit about the Washington, D.C. statute. Washington, D.C., as probably most of you know, is a dangerous city. It's a beautiful city. I've been living in that area for several years now. I came down from Massachusetts. Climate's lovely, very little snow. Beautiful center of the city, but it is a dangerous city, and at times it has actually been the murder capital. In 1976, the district's council passed this gun ban, which forbid anybody who was resident in the city from owning a handgun and keeping it in their own home. You could have a long gun, a rifle, but if you kept it in your home, you had to keep it disassembled or locked up. And you could not put that gun together at any point, even if there was a break-in in your house. If you had a gun in your house, you were not allowed to take it from one room to another within your home. So it was about as strict a gun ban as you can imagine. That you had, if someone broke into your house, you would presumably, if the gun was in your bedroom, have to wait until they actually got to the bedroom. And in the meantime, you would have to be trying to put the thing together. I mean, it's one of the judges during the argument said, you know, if somebody breaks in, you know, and it's 3 o'clock in the morning, the lights are out, how long do you think it's going to take, they asked the man representing the city, the lawyer, to put that gun together. Well, he said, I think maybe a minute. Well, so it was a really, really harsh statute. The plaintiffs were a group of people who had brought the case at the lower court level. They included a woman named Shelley Parker, who had moved into a dangerous area of Washington and noticed when she moved in that there were drug dealers on the corner. She had called the police and notified them several times about the drug trade going on. The drug dealers knew she was the one who had called, and they threatened her that they were going to come and get her. So she applied for a handgun to keep in her home to defend herself and was refused because of this ban. Dick Heller, who the case gets named for, is a security policeman on Capitol Hill. And during the day, he has a gun. But when he applied to get one to have at home, because of the gun ban, he was not allowed. Washington, D.C. claimed that this was a matter of public safety, that there were too many guns around, and so the only thing to do was to ban the guns, and the place would be safer. Anyway, their argument was that we needed it for public safety. What better way to get rid of guns than to ban handguns in the possession of individuals? Then they said, well, the Second Amendment, anyway, was not an individual right. It only mentions a militia, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. And so, therefore, it's only members of a militia that have a right to be armed, and so it's a collective right of states, has nothing to do with individuals. No individual has a right to be armed. And then they pointed out, anyhow, D.C. is not a state, right? And so since the District of Columbia is a district and not a state, I mean, really, if you took that further, none of the Bill of Rights would apply to the District of Columbia. But at any rate, this was an argument seriously made in their brief. And I should say that this case caused so much interest that there were 70 different briefs that were submitted. You get the official brief of the lawyers on each side, and then there were all kinds of other groups that have friends of the court briefs. You had academics on each side. You had a linguistic group who submitted a brief on the linguistics of the Second Amendment. But at any rate, that was it. And then they said, anyhow, people don't need a handgun. They can keep a long gun in their home. Of course, the long gun was supposed to be disassembled and locked, but nonetheless, you could actually have it. And then they said, whatever the Second Amendment guarantees, it does not require the district to stand by while its citizens die. Having a handgun, whether in the home or outside of it, comes at the expense of the safety of those who may be victims. No other provision of the Bill of Rights even arguably requires a government to tolerate serious physical harm on anything like the scale of the devastation worked by handguns. So, as the mayor said again, he could not stand by and watch the citizens of Washington die. There are two serious problems with that argument. One is that there was a study done comparing the homicide rate in the District of Columbia with that of now 49 other major cities. It was done before this law went into effect in 76 and afterwards. And the District of Columbia had a higher rate after the law was in effect than before. So it did not protect citizens. They actually were more likely to be homicide victims afterwards. And the second one, which is a sadder case, I mean, you were supposed to rely on the Washington, D.C. police to protect you. There's a case called Warren versus the District of Columbia, and actually there are other cases of this sort, but this one was particularly ironic because it was the district itself. The U.S. Court of Appeals in the district heard the case of three rape victims who sued the District of Columbia because of negligence on the part of the police. There were three women living together in a townhouse, and two of them were upstairs when they heard men break in and attack their roommate downstairs. After repeated calls to the police, over half an hour, they kept calling 911. The roommate's screams down below stopped, so they assumed that the police had arrived. They went downstairs, and instead they found that these two men were still there. They were held captive, raped, robbed, beaten, forced to commit sexual acts, and to submit to the attacker's demands for 14 hours. The police had lost track of the repeated calls for assistance. The Washington, D.C.'s highest court heard this case. The women sued the police saying, you know, we called 911 and nobody came. And what did the court hold? That the police do not have a legal responsibility to provide personal protection to individuals. Actually said a government and its agencies are under no general duty to provide public services such as police protection to any particular individual citizen. So they protect us all, but they don't protect any one of us, which is not terribly comforting. So it was ironic that the mayor would decide that he couldn't stand by and watch people die when, in fact, you know, this court case brought in Washington had shown that the police didn't feel like they absolutely had a responsibility to protect anyone. And, of course, the city is the one that had defended the police and argued that. Just a couple of comments about the Second Amendment from one of my favorite judges, so I can't resist. This is Alex Kozinski, who's one of the most interesting and eloquent judges on the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit is the California Circuit, known in the trade as the Nutty Ninth. Some of the things that they come up with are a little bizarre, especially to people on the East Coast. But at any rate, he seems to be one of the saner and more solid judges out there. And they had, some years ago, had a special session on what the Second Amendment meant. Did it mean there was an individual right or not? And the judges decided no. He wrote, "It's wrong to use some constitutional provisions as springboards for major social changes while treating others like senile relatives to be cooped up in a nursing home until they quit annoying us. Just go away, you know, let's not think about it." Then he says about the majority on the court. He says, "The majority falls prey to the delusion, popular in some circles, that ordinary people are too careless and stupid to own guns, and we would be far better off leaving all weapons in the hands of professionals on the government payroll. But the simple truth born of experience is that tyranny thrives best where government need not fear the wrath of an armed people. Our own sorry history bears this out." He came from Romania, and so he was very aware of what could be done by a tyrannical government if people didn't have weapons to protect themselves. He said it was the kind of decision that a free people get to make only once. Self-defense is really at the core of the right.
The rights guaranteed by America's Second Amendment come from England's common law and constitution. But since World War I, England has abolished gun ownership and practically abolished the right to defend oneself by any other means. Americans should find interesting how well this experiment has or has not worked in England. To tell us about that, here again is Joyce Malcolm.
The British system had a very different experience from ours, and I've spent a lot of time sort of looking at it, so I'd like to burden you with it. But I hope it will be an interesting comparison, because they started from the same premise that you have this individual right. This is where we got the notion and where we got the idea of the Second Amendment. People have a right to be armed. The British had this until 1920, when after the First World War, there was a lot of concern about all the men who would be coming back from that brutal war and be brutalized, and all the, they were afraid of a Bolshevik revolution, and so they passed an act to register guns, and you had to have a local policeman say that you were a fit person and that you had a good reason to be armed. And that was just the beginning. So it was never made clear what was a good reason, and it was up to the police. And over the years, the home office that's in charge of all the police gradually sort of tightened up what would be permissible, so that by 1964, it was no longer permissible to have a weapon to defend yourself, or even if you had a business, to have a weapon on hand to protect, you know, money on hand. Banks couldn't even have an armed guard. So first they started to register guns and require people to register. And some of the people who were officers during World War I were really incensed when they weren't allowed to have a pistol at home afterwards because some police chief didn't feel that it was necessary. Then in 1953, they passed an act called the Prevention of Crime Act. And this one is very strange. I think this act forbid anybody from going about in a public place carrying anything that could be used as an offensive weapon. So if you had a walking stick with the idea that if somebody attacked you, you would hit them with it, then that was an offensive weapon. It was really your idea that you would use it that way that made it an offensive weapon. There are scholars who've said any article could be an offensive weapon. And sadly, I mean, some people have been arrested for carrying a sandbag or a broken milk bottle or a stone with the idea that these were offensive weapons. At the time that this was being debated, the people in the House of Commons were quite upset. One of them pointed out that there was a woman who worked at the House of Commons, a cleaner, and every night going home, she had to walk across this lonely moorland. Oh, and she carried with her for her protection a knitting needle. And about 2 weeks before they were debating this bill, she had been assaulted and used this knitting needle against her assailant on, as they put it, a tender part of his body. Apparently, it did the trick. So off he went. So the member of the House of Commons said, well, you know, is she not going to be allowed to carry this knitting needle anymore? And the attorney general, who was arguing on behalf of the government, said, people should not have to carry offensive weapons with them. It's the duty of society to protect them. See, society is going to protect her. And so she shouldn't have to worry about protecting herself. There was a member of the House of Lords who said, well, it's the object of a weapon to help weakness defend itself against strength, you know, that to ask someone not to be able to protect people that are with them or their children. It seems wrong. Well, you know, again, the government will do this. There's nothing to worry about. And that anyway, it would be showing very little faith in the government to think that they're going to harass ordinary people. So after 1953, you could not go around with anything in your pocket that might be suggested as a weapon. There's one instance I'd like to read you if I find it. This one is a young man who is stopped by the police at night running on a road, and they searched him. And he was carrying various things: a length of polished steel, a 2-foot length of cycle chain, a metal clock weight, really heavy thing, and a studded glove. So he had 4 things with him that were offensive weapons. He said he had these for his protection because he'd been threatened by a gang of youths. And he was charged under this 1953 Act. And basically, with this act, you are guilty until you prove yourself innocent. So it was sort of the opposite of what the golden mean of English law, that you're innocent until proven guilty. You had to explain why it was okay for you to have this. At any rate, he had reported these incidents where he'd been threatened to the police, which is what you're supposed to do. You know, not to carry anything, but let the police know, they'll take care of it. But of course, you know, the police are not going to be with him all the time. And so he was carrying these weapons. The justices who heard the case found at his hearing that he believed there was an imminent threat against him. This fear proved well-founded because 16 days later, when he was no longer carrying these things, he was attacked and beaten so badly he was hospitalized. The justices at his hearing had held that he had a reasonable excuse for carrying the weapons, and they did not convict him. However, the story unfortunately does not end there, because the prosecutor appealed the case. I don't think we have that. In other words, if somebody's found innocent, I don't think the prosecutor has a right have another go, as they would say in Britain. But apparently in England they can do that. So the prosecutor appealed the case to the Queen's Bench Court, which decided that the defendant did not need to carry all four weapons for protection, and that a reasonable excuse to carry a weapon must be related to an imminent and immediate threat of danger at the time they are carried. If those people had threatened him that day, it would have been okay to carry it that day, but just that day. So the fact that he'd been threatened just generally and was carrying it was not good, so that he had no right to sort of generally carry it. The fact that he was in real fear every time he went out, or that he had notified the police who failed to protect him, cut no ice with the Queen's Bench justices. They were applying a principle enunciated by Lord Widgery in the case of Bryant v. Mott, that for the carrying of a weapon to be reasonable, the threat must be an imminent particular threat affecting the particular circumstances in which the weapon was carried. Lord Widgery also determined that it was reasonable for a man who had actually been attacked to carry something to defend himself for a day or two. Perhaps, he said, a little longer. But stretching this to 7 days was, quote, very close to borderline. So what happened? Well, the case was sent back to the original court with instructions to convict this guy. So back it went because he was not supposed to be carrying these things on a routine basis. So I'll give you a couple of other examples. And alas, there are a lot. There are rules about even defending yourself in your own home with things. They don't have guns. I should say guns were banned in 1998 after the Dunblane shootings in Scotland. There was a campaign to ban all handguns, and everyone that had them, and of course because they were registered there, they knew where they all were, had to turn them in, including antiques and kinds of things, and they were to be smashed or given to museums. So they were all to be handed in. There were actually two amendments to this that were attempted. One was to allow handicapped shooters to have a pistol because it's something that they could really compete in on an equal basis, but that didn't cut any ice either. And the Olympic team was not allowed to have guns either. So the British Olympic team has to practice in Switzerland. They go to Switzerland or France. As they used to be one of the best target shooting teams. But alas, you know, if you have to go abroad to practice, you're not in good shape. So, you know, it was very strict. But did it really protect the people? 5 years after this ban, in which all these guns were handed in, handgun crime actually doubled. And I'll just do a couple of other issues. I think this is what happens when you don't have a right to self-defense. I mean, this isn't even guns. This is anything. I mean, if you clobber somebody who's attacked you in your house and he's hurt, if you actually hurt him, then this is assault. And if you kill him, well, there recently, a Mr. Singh, who had a little shop in an English town, was taking the money from the day's earnings in his car to go to the bank. And a repeat criminal who was, in fact, was wanted at the time because he hadn't shown up at a court hearing and had a whole string of convictions for violence, broke the window of Mr. Singh's car to try to get at him. And he had a knife with him. And in the scuffle, Mr. Singh got the guy with his own knife, and he died. Police came. I think Singh probably called him himself. He was hurt. He had, you know, stab wounds around his head. They immediately took him off to jail in handcuffs because he had killed this man, even though he was defending himself, and that this fellow who he killed was someone who, you know, was known to the police and had a long record. Eventually, there was such an outcry about how outrageous this was that the Crown prosecutor decided maybe not to do this. And so they didn't charge him with murder. But that's what they were planning to. So the man didn't know until the very last moment that he wasn't going to be charged with murder for having protected himself in his own car against someone who attacked him with a knife. But even if you don't use that, you can be in trouble. Another man had two burglars broke into his home, and he had a toy gun that looked real. So he held these two with his toy gun. He pulled out the toy gun, and they thought it was real. And so they stood there while he called the police. And when the police came, they arrested the two burglars, but they also arrested the man with a toy gun for putting someone in fear with a toy gun. I don't want to go into too many of these, but as an American, I sometimes wonder. The most egregious or famous case involved a man named Tony Martin. I don't know if any of you have heard of this. This is a man in his 60s who lived on an isolated farm and in a house that was so bad that when the police actually described it as a shed. So he wasn't a wealthy guy. He had been robbed six times, right? Six times. And I should say that because the people are depending on the police to protect them and there's not that much money, police stations have been consolidated. 70% of the villages in England have no police presence at all. So there's nobody even anywhere near where Martin lived. He's upstairs and he hears glass breaking in the middle of the night and two guys come into the house. They had apparently driven 40 miles. I don't know what they thought was there. I mean, he had been robbed six times, right? And it wasn't much of a house. But at any rate, they were going through his silverware, cutlery and stuff. He crept down the stairs and he had a shotgun and he just shot. It was dark. He shot at these two. One was a 16-year-old who had been involved in a lot of robberies before, and the other was in his 40s and a sort of career criminal. They both left immediately, but the 16-year-old was wounded and died outside, and the other guy was just wounded. The police charged Tony Martin with murder and attempted murder. The surviving burglar, who had, again, had a long, was known to them, had a long string of record, was sent to jail, but not like Martin. Martin was originally supposed to go for life. The prosecutor argued that he had trapped these people, that he had lain in wait for them in his house and caught them like rats in a trap. You know, it's kind of hard to envision somebody on his bed lying in wait for burglars to come. But at any rate, the burglar got off early on parole, but they reduced Martin's sentence to 5 years because on appeal it was found that he had had some kind of abuse as a child, so they let him off early. But they would not parole him because he posed a threat to burglars. So this is, you know, it kind of goes from one thing to another. They have now, I think, tried to clamp down on toy guns. They are clamping down on knives. You have to be 18 to buy a knife. And they're trying to keep knives from having points. And they had a series of French chefs show that you can do really good chopping, you know, without the point. You don't need the point. So much for that. I mean, the idea that you're going to keep people from buying a knife or using one from their kitchen until they're 18. But the one final note on this, and it's, I think it goes to Kaczynski's comment that they feel that people are too stupid to be well-behaved in this. The latest thing is that the powers that be have decided that fire extinguishers are a danger because people won't know how to use them safely. And if you live in a high rise, you know, and you have no experience with using that fire extinguisher and there's a fire, instead of evacuating, you might actually try and put it out. And so they have banned fire extinguishers in high-rise buildings. Now, the fact that the fire department can't get beyond a certain floor is no matter because, you know, what harm you might do by trying to use that fire extinguisher yourself. So there's this sort of this slippery slope of, you know, you can't be allowed to protect yourself. Society will protect you. We'll look after you, even though we can't always do that. It's probably safer if you rely on the police. Just a quick contrast to that, which is an American case. The headline read, "Burglar puts 92-year-old in gun closet and gets shot." The 92-year-old shot the burglar. Got having been shoved in the gun closet. You know, that's a sort of a more American approach. But without guns in the gun closet, the 92-year-old would be very vulnerable indeed.
Thanks for listening. For more information on the show, see newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Stay informed, get involved, and illegitimi non carborundum. See you next week.